The Guardian.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen, sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's subject is a seasonal one. It's that Victorian classic, A Christmas Carol. We chose Charles Dickens particularly as we're about to enter his bicentenary year, and we on The Guardian always pride ourselves on being ahead of the pack. We're lucky enough to have with us his latest biographer, Claire Tomlin, whose book has been one of the year's big successes. John Mullen began by asking her if the Victorian audience responded to the tale in the same way as we do today.
I think there are still people who read it in very much the same spirit that it was read when it was first published. I have met elderly Dickensians, perhaps 20 years ago I met, and they may not still be alive, who told me that they reread it every Christmas, and every summer they reread one of Dickens's novels. I found that deeply moving. The hold it had was really rather extraordinary, because even quite cynical people like Thackeray said, greeted it by saying it was a gift to every man and woman. And Lord Jeffrey said, you know, better than sermons and homilies. I mean, people saw it as having a better message than was given by the church. And perhaps that was partly why it was so popular, that people felt that reading this absolutely thrilling and profoundly sentimental story was much more fun than going to church. The thing that I find extraordinary about Christmas Carol is how it ever got written. And this is a biographer's remark, because if you look at what Dickens was doing, he wrote it in the autumn of 1843. And if you look at all the other things that he was doing in that year, it is absolutely amazing. He was writing Martin Chuzzlewit. He was a bit more than halfway through. Well, you know, that's hard work, producing monthly installments of a big novel. And so he just took up and decided to write, a famous account of him writing, laughing and crying as he ran through the streets of London and sort of in a great ferment of excitement. But the energy that was necessary to do that was extraordinary. The things that were going on in his life that year were both private and public. He read the Commission on Child Employment, which had a huge effect on him, and he planned to write a very cheap pamphlet called An Appeal to the People of England on behalf of the poor man's child. He didn't get around to writing that pamphlet. He wrote A Christmas Carol instead, which Dickens, being so clever, realised that a story would have much more effect than even the best pamphlet. He was going in for a lot of private philanthropy in that year. A friend of his, an actor called Elton, drowned at sea, leaving seven children, and their mother was already dead. Dickens immediately formed a committee, raised enormous sums of money, asked his friend Miss Coutts to contribute, made sure they got enough capital to make sure that all those children would be brought up and trained to be able to earn their own living. Six of them were girls. The youngest, a little boy, actually grew up to become an actor like his father. And they remained in correspondence with Dickens for decades and wrote him a letter of thanks. It was an extraordinary private act. He also, in the autumn of just before he wrote Christmas Carol, he visited a ragged school in London, ragged schools set up by well-meaning people for street children, children who had no parents or neglectful parents, who were half-starved, who were half-dressed, who were in and out of prison. They would have been prostitutes and pickpockets. And Dickens decided to visit one in Saffron Hill, and he wrote a most wonderful letter to Miss Coutts, again hoping ever good Miss Coutts would stump up, and she did. And he described going into it, and there was a lot of religion being offered to these children, and Dickens was always worried about this and thought that perhaps religion was quite meaningless to children who had such totally deprived lives as they had. And he suggested to Miss Coutts that it was much more important to arrange somewhere for the children to wash when they arrived at school. Oh, absolutely spot on. What else was he doing? He was going up to Manchester and Birmingham and Liverpool to help raise money for institutions or polytechnics or something called an Athenaeum, which offered libraries, lectures, cultural information to men and women workers. And Dickens took that very, very seriously. And it occurs to me that out of some of those institutions arose the universities that developed in those cities afterwards. And I think if Dickens were thinking about university education now, he would probably have something to say about what's happening to it, because he thought it was so important. This all links into my favourite part of A Christmas Carol, which is, if you remember at the beginning, Scrooge, who is a rich businessman, is approached by other businessmen and asked if he would give some money for the poor and the unemployed. The story is written in the middle of a terrible depression. Many people are unemployed, many people are hungry, many people are cold. In reality, that was so, and in the story, it is so. And Scrooge, who is a good citizen, asks if, you know, he says there are plenty of ways of dealing with these people. There are workhouses, there are treadmills, there are prisons, you see. They're all in good working order, are they? And the man says, yes, they are. And he says, well, you know, I'm not giving any more money as I've given enough. And then, marvellously, after Scrooge has met the spirits, the second spirit, the spirit of Christmas present, who shows him wonderful, jolly Christmas, lots of food, lots of enjoyable things, at the very end of his time with Scrooge, out of his cloak come two feral children, yellow, scraggy, mean-looking children, the sort of children who might mug you in the street any time. Scrooge says rather nervously to the spirit, are they yours? And the spirit says, they are man's. And he says, this one is want, and this one is ignorance. And ignorance, he says, is the one to watch, because out of ignorance will come the evils that will destroy our city. And Scrooge, who is beginning to have better thoughts, says, is there anything I can do to help? Are there any resources for them? And this marvellous moment when Dickens, all his rhetorical power, he makes the spirit speak Scrooge's own words back to him. He says, are there no workhouses? Are there no prisons? And the chapter ends at that point. To me, that's the climax of the book. It's not how the book was read. That was never seen as the climactic moment, because we never hear about ignorance and want again. No. Everything gets better and better and jollier and jollier, in a sense. But it makes you cheer for Dickens, I think, at that point.
One of the things that is often said about A Christmas Carol, you must tell me how true it is, because I think I probably repeated it without knowing, is that it was partly responsible for sort of creating that ideal or that idea of Christmas?
Well, it certainly encouraged it. It certainly was so popular and so widely read that I suppose it did stand as a sort of model. But there had yes. been Merry Christmases before. I mean, I've just been reading a book about the reign of Henry VII and the Christmas celebrations in that time. Christmas has been celebrated. It reminds me a bit of Babette's Feast, the idea that a really good meal yes. with friends has a moral force, and I think that's absolutely true. It's also a very secular Christmas that Dickens is on about. I mean, in all Dickens's accounts of Christmas, you get occasional mention of people going to church, yes. but that's not the point.
Yes.
The point is the food, the drink, the family, the mistletoe, the blind man's buff, the dancing, the hot pudding.
Yeah.
When Dickens did conjuring tricks at his children's parties, he had a wonderful one in which you take a man's hat and you show flour and eggs and butter, and then you wave it around, and out comes a flaming Christmas pudding. It's a trick I long to see done. I think so. The other thing that mattered to Dickens, and he, over and over again when he writes about Christmas, he says this, that everybody should forgive the people they've quarrelled with, that everyone in the family, all accessible members of the family, should gather together, and you know, nobody should be left out, and every quarrel should be mended.
Yeah. Well, there's a very in the Penguin edition, which you might have won, who knows. There's a collection of not just A Christmas Carol, but other writings on Christmas. And one of them is an essay published in one of his periodicals about Christmas and why it was wonderful. And actually, stripped away from the gripping story of A Christmas Carol, it becomes a bit less plausible because it's just what he says should happen. And he imagines, you know, a family and the daughter of the matriarch who has married the wrong person,
right,
gone off with
right.
the wrong man,
right.
And has been rejected and cast out. But on Christmas Day or Christmas Eve, she comes back, and because it's Christmas, she's sort of received back and everything's forgiven. And because it's not a, because it's a little sketch, it's not a sustained story, it's very difficult not to think, oh, come on, I mean, you know, this notion, or what's going to happen on Boxing Day, or...
Well, Boxing Day wasn't even a bank holiday at that time, of course, not till after...
Well, Bob Cratch has to be back at work on Boxing Day.
Yes, a wonderful suggestion of John Sutherland, his essay on Christmas.
What does he say about it?
Well, he says that if you work out the size of the turkey that that Scrooge sends to the Cratchit family, it couldn't have been cooked on Christmas Day, and that's why Bob Cratchit is late for work when he comes back to work next day. I think there are many ironies always in talking about Dickens at Christmas. I mean, this book, he was so proud of it, and rightly proud of it, because it is a wonderful book, and he insisted that it should be published in a very grand edition with beautiful end papers and gilt lettering, and that it should be a really lovely object for people to have. I think it cost 5 shillings. But he was also sure that he was going to make a lot of money out of it. And he was absolutely dismayed when the royalty statements came in January. He'd expected to be making £1,000, and he only got 230. And it was part of his pretext for quarrelling with his publishers, Chapman and Hall, who had worked with him for years. And in fact, it led to him breaking off his relations with them.
One of the important things about it is that it seems almost designed to be read in a sitting.
This, I think he took a bit more time to read it when he took to reading it aloud. And he then, in fact, cut it down and reduced it. Actually, I read that very soon after it came out, a man in Bristol called Staples decided to read it to the poor. And friends said, oh, no, it'll be wasted pearls before swine. And he gathered, and he spent 2 evenings, and the poor came really rushing in to hear it. And one man said to him it was the happiest evening of his life was sitting.
Yeah.
I think one of the wonderful things about the narrative is it is so cinematic that the spirits carry him. And you do actually feel you're rushing through the air and you're seeing these sights, and Scrooge is suddenly seeing himself as a boy. And that is both cinematic and vivid and also very moving. And another thing that struck me rereading it was, at that moment when he sees himself as a poor boy and he pities himself, that is the moment at which his character changes. I think it's a bit like probably modern psychoanalysis, that he has only to go back to his childhood, perceive that he was a child to be pitied, and that his parents had left him, he had to stay through the holidays at boarding school. Another irony, Dickens, who sometimes left his own sons over Christmas at boarding school in France. Really, after that, he doesn't need any more lessons because he has been melted. Well, the ice in his heart has gone.
Yeah, you're right. That's incorrect. That's very sort of... I mean, Dickens is such an odd mixture, isn't he, of sort of sometimes psychological crudity or simplicity, and sometimes and sort of amazing sort of laser insight. And the thought that being sorry for yourself, your other self, your younger self, is is a kind of chastening, improving, humanising thing, is a very, that seems a very kind of powerful one.
But he can't resist. He has such fun with the last horrible, The Spirit of Christmas to Come. I mean, he lays it on so thick, you know, the dead body and these awful raven-like people robbing Scrooge's house.
I mean, what about the ghosts? I mean,
Well, they're not ghosts. I mean, Marley's ghost is just about a ghost because he's carrying clanking chains and he knows he has to, you know, like an old-fashioned ghost, he has to go at a certain time. But the spirits are not ghosts. In fact, they're rather wonderful creatures.
Yeah, well, all right, spirits.
Full of light.
The supernatural became not an element of all his Christmas story. What was the important... Why was that as associated?
Well, I think people sitting around the fire. I mean, I think Mrs. Gaskell thought the same, that when she and Dickens... In fact, Dickens pinched one of her ghost stories.
Did he? Which one was it?
Well, it's a marvellous story, actually. It's a story of a beautiful young woman, a delicate young woman, who sees a portrait of a man and is very frightened of it, a man she doesn't know. She's about to be married, and her husband has planned to take her to Italy for the honeymoon. And he's a bit fed up with her for being nervous at this portrait. And they go to Genoa, of course, Dickens knew, And one day a Signor dell'Ombre calls, and she shrinks back in horror and hospitality. He said he's a charming, charming man, and you know. And the story goes on, and he keeps calling, and the husband keeps saying, "Pull yourself together, my dear. This is a perfectly nice man. You must overcome your nerves." And then they move on to Rome, and one day the husband has to go out on business in Rome, and she says she's going to stay in bed all day because she's feeling tired. And, he comes back in the evening, and the servant says, your wife has disappeared, and they make inquiries, and somebody at an inn outside Rome has seen a carriage going by with Signor dell'Ombre and a terrified woman crouched in the corner of the carriage. I mean, it's a really frightening story, a woman who sort of foresees the horror that's to come. And I can quite see why Mrs. Gaskell was annoyed that Dickens pinched it from her. But Dickens said, well, ghost stories are common, you know, they're to be shared among people. Because this is what people do in winter. They sit down and tell frightening stories around the fire.
And the peculiar thing about the sort of Dickens version, which seems to me so original and characteristic, is that with the spirits and with some of the genuine sort of horror you get in it, there is, from the word go, this odd sort of, I mean, stir of comedy, I suppose. I mean, you talk Dickens's famous thing, laughing and crying, but actually... You know, I'd forgotten until I reread it that, you know, one of the first things that Scrooge says to Jacob Marley's ghost is, you know, he says, I know people see ghosts because of things they've eaten, because they've got dyspepsia. Yes. I think there's more of gravy than of grave about this vision, know. And,
yes. And then he says, it might be a crumb of cheese in my stomach.
And, and that sort of... you know, and actually Scrooge's nephew says, he's a comical old fellow.
Yes.
And it is comical as well, isn't it?
It is comical, yes.
And that sort of, that's about,
The language, there's a very extraordinary thing when he talks about the house Scrooge lives in an old court.
Yes.
And he says, once this house had been young and playful, and somehow it had got stuck there and hadn't been able to get out. The idea of turning a house into a sort of living creature is very, very Dickens. Yes. And you sort of... It makes you laugh.
And what about you mentioned earlier, the sentimentality? Because as a biographer, you must have sort of thought, right, how am I going to tackle that particular, or do justice to that particular strain in Dickens's writing?
Well, I think some of Dickens's sentimentality is very justifiable, as a matter of fact, because he lived at a time when many, many parents had children who died. And all people sort of laugh at Dickens for writing about Little Nell and Paul Dombey. But he had an intention of comforting people and of offering something that they could hold on to, as it were, something that they could think about it, something that would relieve their pain. And I think that is perfectly justifiable. But curiously, after his nephew died, his sister Fanny died of tuberculosis, and then poor little Henry died. And Dickens, I think I'm right in saying this, I haven't checked it, that he wrote a letter saying he thought it was for the best. So he thought if the child was so very severely handicapped, it was probably more merciful that he should have died.
In the beginning of Claire's biography, those of you who haven't read it or getting it for Christmas, there's a section, it starts with this extraordinary picture of a 28-year-old Dickens going to a trial at of a woman who's accused of killing her baby. Yes. Sort of, you can imagine the other sort of members of the jury are these slightly kind of smug, reasonably affluent Victorian citizens who are very ready to say, "Oh yes, cart her off, she's guilty." And Dickens goes to sort of great lengths to first of all to sort of see that her case is properly sort of aired and listened to, and seems almost instrumental in kind of helping her to get off the accusation of murder, and then helping her afterwards. I mean, you put that in right at the beginning. Is that as a sort of antidote to the speed with which we read his stories of suffering children and say, "Oh, so sentimental"?
Well, I didn't quite think of it like that, though. I did think hard about the sentimentality thing. I think I put it in because I didn't want to start with who his parents were, who his grandparents were, what his childhood was. Because I wanted to somehow bring Dickens in, sort of all guns firing, and I wanted to sort of show him at the sort of peak, in a way, of his life, and try and give a sort of quick overview of what he was like. And that particular case was so striking. As always, he was so busy. And I was also interested, and it never struck me until I really worked on Dickens, that he was living in the very grand house, Devonshire Terrace, which he'd just moved into. And he'd got this lovely house just south of Regent's Park. And the workhouse, which had been there since the 18th century, was just along the road. And the workhouse was like a town, a great mass of buildings, at least a thousand people. And workhouses were actually partly where children whom nobody could trace the parents of were brought up. They were also where all domestic servants ended. Surveys of who were in the workhouses then were people who'd spent their whole lives working for middle-class families. And when they couldn't work anymore, there was nothing for them because there were no old-age pensions. And they went into the workhouse and stayed in the workhouse till they died, wearing a uniform and sleeping in dormitories. And Dickens so hated workhouses and all they stood for. I just thought it was somehow that it concentrated a lot of things about Dickens's goodness and his energy and about the sort of London he lived in and what was going on in it. That was why I began like that. I mean, it's always difficult to know how to start a book. Yes. It's always difficult to start writing.
You describe Dickens's quite a lot in your biography. Dickens's extraordinary sort of performances of his fiction, and of course he performed a version anyway of A Christmas Carol. But as I think I'm right in saying, not for quite a long time.
No.
Not till the 1850s.
No. Of course, it was dramatised immediately.
Yes, dramatised.
In February 1844, there were, I think, 8 different dramatised versions being played in London. It's another thing that's wonderful about Dickens, that even the illiterate could get their Dickens stories just by going to the theatres. And it didn't just get played in London. Yeah. It was played touring theatre companies all over the British Isles. So that's another reason that his characters took such a sort of hold on the imagination of the whole nation.
And what about his... I mean, it seems sometimes reading A Christmas Carol, though it could have been written for performance, because one of the things that, if you've only seen film versions, however accurate of the narrative, that will immediately strike you if you read the book, is that there's this narrator who's in there. And sometimes he actually says things like, "I'm standing by your elbow," doesn't he, at one stage. And, I mean, it's this wonderful opening. Marley was dead to begin with. That's another answer. Wonderful opening. But then he says, old Marley was as... I love it. He says, old Marley was as dead as a doornail. And I always think that sort of when people say, we shouldn't use cliché, Dickens loved a cliché, didn't he? And he loved a cliché, but he didn't just use a cliché, he threw it around and lobbed it in the air and mucked about with it. And he says, old Marley was as dead as a doornail. And then he says, mind, I don't mean to say that I know of my own knowledge that there is particularly dead about a doornail. I might have been inclined myself to regard a coffin nail as the deadest piece of ironmongery in the trade. But the wisdom of our ancestors is in the simile. It's fantastic. Yeah, yeah. He's sort of doing
Doesn't he go on and talk about Hamlet's ghost?
Yeah, that's
the same
later on,
That's right. Oh, Hamlet's father. If we were not perfectly convinced that Hamlet's father died before the play began, there would be nothing more remarkable than his taking a stroll at night in an easterly wind upon his own ramparts.
Yes.
I mean, you're in there having a good time with Dickens, aren't you?
And even when he's at his most, I suppose, sententious or also sentimental, quite often it's the same sort of person doing it. He'll sort of exclaim, won't he? Poor fellow, he will say.
Yes.
Bod Cratchit.
Yes.
You know, which it sort of reminds me of how my grandfather used to watch television like this. If he saw a film where something unfortunate happened to a good person, he would say, poor fellow. As if he was right in there.
I still do that.
And it's sort of... I wonder if you sort of thought this more generally about Dickens's fiction, that one of the reasons that people love it and are sometimes exasperated is that it's the same thing, that he has the sort of audacity and bad taste to be right in there all the time, sort of telling you things and pulling at you and talking to you, instead of, you know, doing the proper thing that a novelist should do.
I knew a lot of 19th century authors. Reader, I married him. I mean, yes. You know, a lot of them. A lot of
But
them.
That's Jane Eyre, isn't it?
Well, George Eyre. Well, yes. But yeah. George Eliot also sort of draws you in, doesn't she?
She does, but her sort of, when she talks...
Thackeray.
Well, yes, when she talks to you, it's in a very sort of, you know, wise, the panoptic way, don't you think?
Whereas her voice is different. Her voice is different, yes. Yes.
Whereas you can't, I mean, I can't think of another writer, although writers will try to do it nowadays, but I can't think of another writer who sort of has the daring, really, just to use this sort of dead phrase.
Yes.
And then immediately, he's just started the story to go off, I think they call it riffing, you know, they came to call it riffing in the 1980s, contemporary novelists, to go off sort of ruminating about the phrase and whether it's a good one and what phrases might be better.
He's got tremendous confidence, and I think at this moment in his life, he, although Martin Chuzzlewit was not doing well and was not making money and was not selling well, he actually wrote an impassioned letter to his friend Forster saying that he felt he was at the height of his powers now, that he'd never had such power as a writer, and that he knew he could do it. He just needed a rest and all those sort of things. That's true. He is writing with that terrific confidence that he can sort of dare anything.
Yes, yes. It's that sort of thing, yes. When you first meet Scrooge, you know, there's, instead of sort of letting you slowly kind of see what kind of person he is, you just get, oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge, exclamation. And it's kind of two clichés in those, you know, tight-fisted, grindstone, it's all just sort of, but all twisted and buckled together in a new way. It's fantastic.
I think you should do a public reading.
What?
I think you should do a public reading. It's very good.
No, don't goad me. Don't goad me. What about? Can I tell you the paragraph I like least? And you can tell me whether you agree with me. And also because it's about the other sort of bête noire of people who have their doubts about Dickens, and it's a topic on which you definitely are the world expert, which is Dickens and women and what he thought of women, because there's a paragraph when Christmas Present, when you're seeing Scrooge's nephew having a good time, and you get Scrooge's nephew's wife, whose name I think you never get told. I think you don't get ever told her name. You get told the nephew's name eventually when Scrooge goes around. They says, I'm looking for Fred. But you get the wife.
His brother's name.
And she exclaims, "More shame for him, Fred," about said Scrooge's niece indignantly. And then suddenly this person, again, Dickens in there, goes, "Bless those women. They never do anything by halves. They are always in earnest." And I'd be okay. I kind of forgive him maybe for that. But then he tells us about her. "She was very pretty, exceedingly pretty, with a dimpled, surprised-looking capital face, a ripe little mouth that seemed made to be kissed, as no doubt it was, all kinds of good little dots about her chin." It's the little word. That's the L word. I think it's always danger, little. "That melted into one another when she laughed, and the sunniest pair of eyes you ever saw in any little creature's head. Altogether, she was what you would have called provoking, you know."
Oh.
"But satisfactory, too." Oh, perfectly satisfactory.
No, it's not very nice. It's like Ruth Pinch. Oh, fluttering, panting, frightened little heart. Oh, God. Yes.
I mean, you're not going to attempt to get him out of that.
No, I don't think. I don't think you can get him out of that.
It's that sort of... Yes, it's
something. There's always a bit of a problem when young women appear, isn't it? Until you get to the late ones, or until you get to Bella Wilfer, for instance. And
well, they're also sort of made to measure, or
well, they're always sort of little, as you say, little, and I don't know.
And what about, before I throw it open to everybody else, what about the ending? I suppose, because his repentance seems complete and immediate, and as soon as he's seen his own gravestone, that's it, and he sort of immediately becomes a sort of a good person.
Well, I think as soon as he says, "Poor boy," yeah, right. Yes,
so that's the, I mean, that's the sort of that's a yes, defence of.
Yes, and it's very easy. I mean, it's very easy. We're not told what he did with his stocks and shares, or
yes.
We're just told he helped the Cratchit family, yes. And got on well with his nephew,
yes.
and celebrated Christmas very well. Yes. Was known for his good celebration, yeah, of Christmas. I think logic is not what we look for in A Christmas Carol. I mean, it's a fancy, it's a game, it's a wonderful confection with a good idea in it about how good it is for us to sit down with people we love, and even with people we're learning to love or getting on better than we expected, and
to drink plenty of hot bishop.
Conviviality was the sort of chief characteristic of Dickens, really. I mean, his whole life he planned dinners. When he finished writing a book, he would have a dinner to which all the printers would be invited, and the publishers and his friends, and a jaunt, a dinner, a feast was. What was it? Lionel Trilling said, "The mere record of his conviviality is exhausting."
Well, let me throw it open to you now. Any questions that you'd like to ask Claire about A Christmas Carol or anything to do with Dickens?
I've read, I think, all of your books, and I'm an enormous admirer. But readings were very important to Dickens, and it interests me that there's a particular time when Smith, his manager, had died. And another man, Headland, became his manager, who was a complete disaster. And some quite funny letters that Dickens writes about this man. He calls him Block Headland, etc., etc., etc. And I think Dickens actually gave up performing because this man made so many mistakes. This worthy man capable of error, he calls him. And I'm wondering why this tends to be ignored, this incident in this very important part of Dickens' life.
Well, clearly I'm at fault here in that I've made nothing of it. I would say in extenuation that the press of events in Dickens' life is so great that if you're going to cover all these things, I remember it. I suppose I got so delighted by the next manager, George Dolby, who is a terrific character, that I've given a great deal of space to him because he wrote a wonderful book about his relationship with Dickens and was a character himself. But I'm sorry, I should have probably spent... No, but it's very interesting what you say. Yes, I remember. Dickens, of course, was a terrific quarreller with people. When he fell out with someone or thought someone wasn't doing their job well, that was it. And similarly, if he loved someone like Dolby, he was always... giving Dolby, sent from America, a pony and cart for one of Dolby's children. I mean, sort of amazing gestures he made.
Going back to what you were talking about, the slightly cringy scene with the description of the woman, I can't remember who it was,
it's the nephew's wife, yes.
But a similar scene that struck me as slightly odd to today's eyes is the bit where I think there's children romping on... Scrooge's sweetheart, who's now left him. And there's a bit where Dickens starts imagining how much fun it would be to have a kind of adult awareness of a woman's body, but be a child jumping on
her. He does say something peculiar.
And that reminded me of something Orwell, I think, wrote about the kind of quasi-incestuous reveries Dickens sometimes goes into. And I wondered if that was something Victorian or something unique to Dickens, or both.
Maclise, Dickens's friend... at one point said he was worried that Dickens always liked these little girls like Florence Dombey and Little Nell, and that he thought that it was not a taste he shared, and he obviously thought there was something not very good about it.
This has been so interesting. I mean, there's a lot I wanted to join in with. I mean, first, one thing I want to point out, I mean, Dickens died in 1870 when the Education Act, Forster's Education Act, came in, so, I mean, help was at hand, his obsession with education. But what I wanted to ask you about, the process of writing a biography of somebody who's been written about so much before, I mean, do you read them? Do you put them out of your mind? How do you set about writing?
Well, you've probably read them. My much admired friend Michael Slater, I told him I wouldn't read his book because I thought, and which he understood. I know it's a wonderful book, but on the whole, you have a lifetime's reading over many years. I've read probably, I won't say all the biographies of Dickens, but many of them. Well, that's part of your work, but much more important was reading all Dickens's letters, rereading them, annotating them, you know, 12 volumes of them, and great pleasure was rereading all his novels.
So did you do that in one sort of go?
Well, I did several years. Yeah. I mean, you can't do it very fast. Some of them I reread twice, like Bleak House, because I like it so much. And the thing is, you never stop finding things. You must know this. Yeah. And you know, I keep finding things now that the book is written, and I'm being told things too, which I find very interesting. None of your books sort of stop when you publish them. They sort of go. You go on thinking about them. I did a lot of research on Dickens 20 years ago when I wrote a book called Invisible Woman, and I went back to all that material, of course. You just sort of beaver away. When people say, how do you write books? I say, you just do it, don't you?
I'd like to, on your behalf, I think, as well, I'd like to thank you for coming. I know, but on your behalf,
yes,
I'd especially like to thank Claire for coming and talking to us this evening.
Well, I say thank you to you. Thank you.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen is sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar. Cornish cheddars made with over 60 years of knowledge, time and skill. To find out more, please visit davidstowecheddar.co.uk.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.